Welcome, folks, to Film Strips, the podcast in which I finally remember to point out that all the music you're hearing on this program is by one Andrew Kanagizer. So let's all give him a round of applause, please. He is more than well-deserved.
David, you're too kind. I think calling 20-second loops that I made on my phone when I'm bored in class, calling it music, though, it's a testament to how kind-hearted you are.
Oh, thank you very much. It is fine and well done work, though, and certainly beats anything I could turn out. So, we'll go. That's certainly the case. But
you won't know until we try. I mean, maybe you'll be the next Neil Young.
No. But yes, I'm Dave Babbitt,
and I'm Andrew Carnegie, sir.
And yes, so welcome back to Film Strips, the show in which we talk about movies that have to link together in some way, shape, or form. Based upon the people involved. And last episode, we talked about a little film called Michael Mann's Heat.
Is that the working title? Is he getting the Tyler Perry treatment now?
Oh, as far as I'm concerned, he always gets the Tyler Perry treatment. But I will say, Andrew, that this is probably the episode that has achieved the most vocal reaction from people so far. Which is to say, James apparently was... Yeah, yelling back in his car as he was listening to us, wanting to interject at various points.
Oh, wow. I need to get in touch with him. Friend of the show, James Rivnak.
Yes. It was a very heated episode, and we decided at the end of it, and by we, I mean me, to follow Art Linson, producer of Heat, and by all accounts a very accomplished producer, to the one and only film he ever directed, 1980's Where the Buffalo Roam, starring Bill Murray as Dr. Hunter S. Thompson, and one Peter Boyle, who, I should point out for the record, gets top billing here, which might just be the only time that has ever happened in the history of cinema.
I noticed that, too. I think it's an alphabetical thing.
Okay, that could be. Technically, he was in, prior to this, Mel Brooks' Young Frankenstein. And Bill Murray was just getting, was just coming off of Saturday Night Live and Meatballs at this point. But yes, but Peter Boyle stars as Carl Laszlo, a character which we'll get more into him in a few minutes. And based upon the article/obituary... written by by Hunter Thompson. I won't put any.
Yeah, the grade is really depending on who you ask, but yeah. It's mostly adapted from his eulogy for his deceased friend, The Banshee Screams for Buffalo Meat, published in Rolling Stone magazine. But a lot of the film also draws upon certain elements and anecdotes from the Thompson-verse at large.
Yeah,
so it's not a strict adaptation in a novelistic sense, as much as it has the main framework, but everything is filled in with things that you know from Thompson's books, and basically all appeared in the far superior Terry Gilliam adaptation of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Yeah, but which I guess brings us to the question of, A, why are we doing this film, and B, who the heck is Hunter S. Thompson in the first place? And the short answer for why we're doing this film is that we're doing, and the reason I thought...
Yeah, David, why are we doing this? Better question. Why did you do this to me? I gave you Michael Mann, and this is how you repay me.
To be fair, I gave you options prior to recording last time.
That's true. That's true. So,
we could be talking about Miracle Mile right now, folks. I just like to point that out for the record. But, reasons we decided to do this one. One, not too long ago, I got my hand on the Shout Factory Blu-ray of this film. So, like I said, it seemed a perfect excuse to rewatch it again and explore it in depth.
So, for those keeping score at home, Where the Buffalo Roam has a Blu-ray release, and Human Highway is still out of print.
Yes. But, having said that, the more pressing issue is the fact that, the figure of Hunter S. Thompson, and most notably Hunter S. Thompson and his friend and lawyer, Acosta, who figures prominently into Thompson's great works in more subdued fashion. We'll say put it like that for now. Certainly coded fashion, I guess, is the best way to maybe describe it, are very interesting individuals, and I would think it's very safe to say, Andrew, misunderstood individuals as far as their position in popular culture and culture at large and how they sort of come out of 1960s counterculture and their sort of placement within it. And again, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas was certainly back when I was in school, I mean, predominantly in high school. You know, this I was in high school right after that film had come out. And there was something of a Thompson Renaissance, I guess you could call it, at least in terms of his, people's cultural awareness of him amongst younger generations. And it kind of put him on a map where, yeah, suddenly he, for people like me who were born in the mid-80s, we knew who this guy was, to an extent. Doesn't mean we understood him, but we knew about him.
Well, yeah, it's he, because Gilliam's film comes out in 1997, I believe?
98. It was released right up against Roland Emmerich's Godzilla.
Oh, wow. Really, really competing for that box office boffo.
Yeah.
But yeah, for people in our generation, that's kind of our first real exposure. Because it's one thing to read Thompson. It's another because, for better or for worse, you know, the film presents him as a very distinct and it's certainly a memorable figure, and you only need to read any of his writing to sort of bridge the two of those together. And for a generation of young, angry, adolescent men who see themselves as artists and that, Thompson is a pretty important figure to a lot of people, because all of a sudden here's a guy who's, you know, probably too smart for his own good, completely disenchanted with where society is going. So what's his response? Well, depending on how you look at it, a lot of people see, oh, well, he just lives completely hedonistically and impulsively. You know, maybe it's self-destructive, but it looks pretty fun at the same time.
Yeah, the other way to sort of look at him as this is a guy who, you know, basically, I think as he's put it himself, numbs the pain by pretty much overindulging in drugs. And not exactly dropping out, but almost becoming, I would think, detached is the best way.
Especially in this film, he is presented as a figure that just sort of floats through. And I think that speaks to maybe a confusion in how we think of counterculture, in the sense where it's like, you know, Thompson is not a hippie, for instance. He's not necessarily a radical either. He's a person that knows what he is against, and Richard Nixon in his writings figures in as emblematic of everything that he stands in opposition to. But it's not as simple as, oh, he was a freewheeling lefty, he wasn't exactly a Timothy Leary type. More than anything, I think you can understand him as a absolute libertarian, where above all, human freedom, personal expression, personal freedom is the prime virtue. And the moment that any system of thought tries to co-opt that, that's the moment that you need to resist.
Yeah, and I think the other thing to sort of note about Thompson is because Thompson, as we know, because we really haven't explained this, Thompson was a journalist, first and foremost. And this is somebody who wrote for Rolling Stone magazine, who'd been started off as a sports writer, and originally gained fame for writing basically writing an expose about the Hell's Angels, in which he pretty much became one of them for a short while.
Well, yeah, it's that point where new journalism, sort of the form, Tom Wolfe as one example, Gay Talese is another, where it's the journalist is no longer objective, that in telling the story that they want to tell, they themselves are written in as a character. And so Thompson takes it that degree further and comes up with what's later known as gonzo journalism, where he throws himself headlong into the story, and to the point where, say, in Fear and Loathing, it's not necessarily about anything but his experience moving through.
Which we should also point out for the record is another thing that's worth noting about Thompson is that the line between autobiography, journalism, and fiction is, you know, practically non-existent in many ways, or at least very hard to discern, because we refer to, you know, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas is sort of an autobiographical work, which it is to an extent, but it is, you know, still, you know, Thompson's stand-in is somebody by the name of Raoul Duke. It's not, you know, Hunter S. Thompson presenting himself as such. And this becomes kind of, you know, a central point in trying to figure out how you deal with the man, because ostensibly you could sit there and say that there are, I would say, argue are three incarnations of Thompson. There's the actual historical person that existed. There's the persona that ends up developing based out of, you know, how popular perception of his work and the persona he's putting out as part of his gonzo journalism, which is, as we sort of noted here, this sort of hedonistic, drug-fueled individual. And then there's the sort of larger-than-life myth that ends up being born out of, in maybe large part, films like Where the Buffalo Roam, and certainly by Terry Gilliam's adaptation of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and furthered even by, say, The Rum Diary, which...
I wouldn't I'm sure say furthered, but yeah, I think you're right, where when you're discussing Thompson, he always strikes me as someone that's very self-aware. And I mean, to the point where, like, he campaigned for political office sort of on that image of himself. So you're right. There's Thompson, the man, there's Thompson as he narrativizes himself. And then there's Thompson as he's narrativized by culture. And there's a lot of play and slippage, and I think, his frequent use of pseudonyms and sort of just the nature of his, like, unbelievably sensationalist style of storytelling, there's a lot of room for play there, and that's something that I feel is often easy to overlook or to simply equate all three into one.
Yeah.
And I think doing that kind of, it almost takes away from Thompson's ability as a sort of storytelling trickster, in a sense. Like, he's very purposeful, I feel, in his writing, even when it seems at its most random. And I think a testament to that is many people emulate Thompson's writing style, or certainly his life experiences, but there's something unmistakable about when you're reading his own work.
Well, it's actually interesting you bring that up, because one of the interesting things on this Blu-ray, the one and only special feature on it, is an extended interview with John Kay, who wrote the screenplay for Where the Buffalo Roam. And one of the points he makes is that, you know, he spent a significant amount of time with Thompson, by his own admission, palling around and doing drugs with him. But the one thing he says is that, you know, that he noticed about Thompson was, Thompson, above and beyond anything, really took his work as a writer seriously. Like, this is a person who took the craft, who sweated over the details of what he was putting down on the page, and who was prone to memorizing, you know, what he considered to be noteworthy passages from, you know, significant writers that were important to him, as it were. So, and that's something I don't think, which, again, to sort of come back to my initial encounters with Thompson, and I think for the generation that of young people who encountered him, in large part thanks to Gilliam's Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, was kind of lost on them, because so many people, I think, look at Thompson and they see the caricature that is built up, which is, this is the, you know, the drug-fueled Marx brother who's wandering into situations, you know, and just doing things, you know, as you sort of know, Andrew, impulsively, and, you know, fueled by whatever narcotic he's taken, and that it's all freewheeling and sort of meandering.
Yeah, with sort of a Marx orphan, maybe, would be a better way to put it. It's, and, like, you gotta remember that this was a man who was celebrated as a journalist, as, like, a published, like, novel-length writer. He had press credentials to follow along with the 1976 presidential campaign. You don't get these things if you're a hack, you know? It's not like Robert Ludlum and Stephanie Meyer got to follow Barack Obama around.
Well, yeah, no, certainly. And I think this is, I think, and it's kind of an interesting thing, because I admit, when I first encountered Thompson, I will flat out say this, because I read Fear and Loathing, the book, in high school the first time, and I did not get it. I sort of dismissed him as a junkie who, was self-aggrandizing, which really, I think, again, was a total misreading on my part.
I don't know about a total misreading. I think he, especially Fear and Loathing, it's very of its time. And sort of you have to place it within a particular cultural context, a particular yes. cultural set of attitudes, and a particular moment in American history. And I think unless you do that, it's easy to see, okay, well, this guy's just talking about doing peyote and going to casinos. Why do we care? And I think there are moments like his very widely regarded The Wave passage, where he sort of yeah. laments the promise and frustrated potential of the counterculture movement, and sort of the moment where you could see the wave roll back. I think when you reread it and sort of you come back to it, you understand that, well, this is all a response, and this is a response to something. There is, whether he's overt or covert about it, he's writing about this and doing these things for a reason.
He certainly is, but I think the sort of where I was leading it is I think there is a tendency with Thompson, because he is so autobiographical, however you want to sort of pursue that in terms of how he writes and how he positions himself in his work. The thing about it is, I think it was very easy for at least young me to see him as a guy who's sort of setting himself up as sort of a narrative hero, which I don't think Thompson actually does. I think Thompson has some very strong opinions, obviously, for anybody who's read his work. I don't think Thompson ever was of the perception that he was somebody to be emulated necessarily. I think he's far more self-critical than I think certainly my initial reaction to him was.
Well, that speaks to his famous quote where what does he say? I wouldn't recommend insanity and drug abuse to other people, but they've always worked for me.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things, which is a line that is features into Where the Buffalo Roam in mm-hmm. the film is performed, but I think kind of misses the some of the actual bite.
Yeah.
But we'll get into that in a moment. So or I guess we should probably just sort of head into it now.
Well, no, if I may, to contextualize yeah. a bit, crucial in Thompson's work is his long-running friendship with Oscar Zeta Acosta.
Yes,
who right. is, you know, he is often masked. He's the character often referred to as Dr. Gonzo, who was a real-life figure, an attorney in Los Angeles, who eventually got fed up with the system and went along with him on his adventures. But if you read about the real-life Acosta, who disappeared under unknown circumstances in 1974... he was a very outspoken activist within the Chicano movement in early 1970s Los Angeles. He was an activist through and through. He was a deeply problematic figure, but he also, like Thompson, was doing everything for a reason. And yes. I guess turning to the film, though, David, we end up seeing two very different... we see two very different portrayals of these men from their own representations of themselves and how they've appeared in other different media. And in the case of Acosta, we get someone else entirely.
Yeah, because this is the thing that was interesting, because one of the things that John Kay, the screenwriter, noted was he was originally approached to adapt Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas to film, which he himself admits he dismissed it originally as just a drug romp that he wasn't particularly interested in pursuing. He did, however, end up finding Thompson's, again, this eulogy, The Banshee Screams for Buffalo Meat, fascinating because so much of it was about the relationship between these two men and, you know, how they sort of evolved over time. And that was something he wanted to explore. Now, the exact legalities surrounding using Acosta as a figure in the cinematic portrayals, I can't speak to. I don't know whether there was ever a point in which it was discussed whether they could actually use Acosta's real name in the film and present him as himself, or whether the plan was always to put in a stand-in. I would imagine it probably would lean to the latter option, only because one gets the sense that, first of all, by this point, likely it would be Acosta's family that would have to be signing off on this, and I'm not sure that they would ever do that based upon much of what Thompson has written and how he's presented Acosta himself in his own works. But two, I mean, okay, putting that aside, you could theoretically make that work. And again, with Bicinio del Toro's presentation of Dr. Gonzo in the Fear and Loathing film adaptation from Gilliam, it kind of does. That's not the approach they took here, however.
No, it really isn't. So, yes. I guess, how does the film set itself up then, David? Presumably, Kay wants to tell the story of these two men and their friendship. So, what do we get?
Well, the film we get, is the general gist of where the Buffalo roams is, we are pretty much seeing Hunter S. Thompson up in his Aspen home base, where, you know, frustrated and needing to write something for reasons that are not necessarily clear.
We just know he has a deadline.
Yeah, he has a deadline. It leads to stuff such as him shooting his fax machine.
How's he going to send the article in?
Well, I think that's besides the point at this point.
It shouldn't be beside the point.
So, it shouldn't be, but like I said, I mean, if we're going to stop with every digression like that,
good
we're
going
to be here a long time.
True enough.
But yeah, basically for unclear reasons, Thompson, here played by Bill Murray, decides to reminisce about his good friend Carl Laszlo.
Carl Laszlo, yes.
Ugh. Yes, who is discernibly, as we will quickly discover, not a Mexican-American, but a white American played by Peter Boyle. And what we end up seeing is the film is structured around more or less three vignettes.
Yes.
We get 1968 in San Francisco when Thompson is covering Laszlo's defense of a group of young hippies, we shall say, who have been busted and are facing deep, deep prison sentences for drug possession.
Yeah, Laszlo's defending them on trial, arguing that, well, the police have no authority to breach Fourth Amendment rights, and it's very much set up as Thompson and Laszlo as defenders of youth culture against the oppressive hand of the man.
Yeah, we then jump ahead following that segment to the Super Bowl in, what is it, 72?
72, I believe.
Yeah, 72-71, where, yeah, we end up seeing Thompson is ostensibly supposed to be covering the Super Bowl. And after some shenanigans at the hotel, encounters Laszlo again, who, in the time since 1968, has A, been in prison, and given up practicing the law to become more or less a gun-running revolutionary for vaguely defined...
Yeah, because reasons. Because it needs to move the plot forward.
Yep, and Thompson sort of getting co-opted along into sort of helping Laszlo accomplish this. And then this leads to even later in 1972, which is based off Thompson's probably arguably second most famous book, Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail of 72, which is him on the plane covering Nixon's re-election campaign. And at this point, you know, basically getting kicked off the plane, being stuck with the more or less political roadies, I guess is the best way to put it.
Yeah.
Then ultimately encountering Laszlo once again after a noteworthy encounter with a certain highly important political figure himself under peculiar circumstances, we shall say. But
yeah, so this film presumably sets itself up as a recollection of their friendship, flashing back on how that friendship has evolved through time, and ends with him effectively eulogizing his friend. So here's my question to you, David. Why is this film so terrible at every possible turn?
Okay, so here's the thing I'm going to say. I'll be flat up off the bat, Andrew. I enjoy this movie more than you did. That's not to say it's a good movie, because it isn't. There are many, many flaws. But if you take this as an excuse to watch Bill Murray, you know, play Thompson, and, you know, in a very not Murray's performance, but Murray play Thompson well in a very superficial film and playing off of Peter Boyle, who himself, you know, regardless of who, despite the other stuff we'll get into, does turn in a good performance in this movie.
Yes.
You know, if we're looking strictly in those terms.
The actors act well, and yeah. I mean, that's the weirdest thing about Murray's role in the film, where he does a, you know, it's not necessarily over the top. It's a pretty good version of Hunter Thompson on screen. The problem is, why would you go through all that effort into emulating a person when there's absolutely nothing in the script for you to do? Like, and here's my, the problem that I want to speak to first, David, is that this is a film that's structured around their friendship. But about midway through the film, it's no longer about their friendship, it's just about Thompson. And then it ends with him eulogizing his friend, but like, for the remaining 45 minutes of the film, we're just following Thompson around, and Laszlo disappears from the film. Aside from that first episode, he walks back into the film, like, as if, almost like, as magic realism. Like, in that third episode, he only appears somehow being at the airport, knowing what plane Thompson is on, walking on and sitting beside him to have a conversation. And that's the extent of his involvement. And, like, there's never that moment. Okay, the problem is, we are given from the outset that these two men are friends. We're given, like, a sentence or two of voiceover narration saying, "Oh, Carl Laszlo, we were great friends, we shared the same cause." And that's all the setup. There's no investigation into their relationship. There's no depth to it. We're just told, "Oh, we're friends. Now follow us on wacky adventures."
Well, and this is the thing about the film when I call it a superficial piece, because the problem with it is I think you get the sense, particularly listening to John Kay, that there were, everybody was kind of at a crossroads, because apparently his original script was a more serious exploration of Thompson, and everybody's reaction was, okay, that's fine, but we want to make it more of a comedy. And they kept pushing him to do it. Now, I'm not saying I buy Kay's defense completely on that. I mean, it's certainly possible, but like I said, I say, obviously, we should take that with a grain of salt.
Because if you ask the actors, Murray and Boyle both have gone on record saying that they thought the script was terrible from the outset, but they signed on to it.
Yeah, and that's the thing about it. It's very hard to know really what happened, when, and why as far as the screenplay goes. But it seems to me that there's a combination of factors that are at play here. One is, number one, this is a film that, regardless of whether Kay, you know, was actually told to make it, you know, more of a comedy or not, the point of the matter is the film ends up, first of all, leaning into a superficial look at Thompson, and particularly is interested in Thompson the persona, rather than necessarily the man himself. So that's problem number one. Problem number two, Art Linson is not a director. And
or at least not a very good one.
Well, that's the thing, because the problem here is, and I think to speak to what you're talking about, Andrew, when Laszlo, like, magically reappears at points, there's a line in the movie when Thompson is giving a lecture at a university, when somebody asks him about whether Laszlo was just something he's cooked up or not, and not a real person, and he goes on to sort of point, it's like, no, I could never make up somebody like this. I think what was probably originally intended, at least as far as what Kay was putting on in the script, was the idea that, yeah, this is possibly all, you know, no matter what we're seeing, this is all Thompson's sort of drug-hazed memories and fueled things, which is exactly what the film is set up to be. This is all the reminiscences of Thompson about his friend, ostensibly.
Okay, let me stop you there, David, and let me warn you, because I might get into rant territory. That is, I think, the most infuriating part of this film, though, because Laszlo's real-life analog, Acosta, he He was a very important figure, especially for the Chicano movement. He was a very real figure. So for the film to try and present him as this ephemeral, like, totem of craziness, I yes. think that is insulting and a disservice. I think it speaks... it's a more damning indictment of the film's whitewashing, because it's yes. one thing to do colorblind casting. You know, Charlton Heston played a Mexican in Touch of Evil. The film is still pretty good. So that's not necessarily a problem in itself. The problem is how, in recoding Acosta in this film, they effectively neuter any cultural or, you know, any specific political impact that he had. And for instance, let me ask you this, David. Why is this film called Where the Buffalo Roam? And why was Thompson's eulogy called The Banshee Screams for Buffalo Meat?
Because Acosta's own did write his own sort of... I'm not sure whether you'd call it an autobiography or not, but certainly a sort of memoir, in which he... I'm trying to remember what the exact title of it was, but it did ostensibly refer to himself as The Buffalo.
I believe it's Autobiography of the Brown Buffalo.
Yes.
And yes, Acosta also wrote two books, very much in the same style as Thompson. You can certainly make the argument that Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas would not have existed had it not been for Acosta. And yes. in his own work, though, it's an exploration of his own identity and finally discovering meaning in his life by identifying with his roots in Mexico.
Yes.
And fighting on behalf of Mexican Americans who are disenfranchised and pushed out of the system. That is why he became a lawyer in the first place. The idea of the buffalo was him assigning that identity to himself as like a symbol of his own heritage. So this is so bizarre because it's a film that completely ignores any aspect of identity politics. It completely disregards the political component to either man, and yet the film still names itself after that very identity that it's trying to erase.
And on top of which, if we go back to the point I was saying about the idea of this being Thompson's memories, at no point in time does Art Linson make film this like it's a subjective film. This is, you know, he flatly puts the camera down and just sort of lets Murray and Boyle tear loose. It's so filmed in such a rather dull, objective style that you never get the sense that even if we assume that the film was aiming to make the Acosta stand-in, for all as problematic as an approach as this is, into the sort of ephemeral, almost hallucinogenic figure that may or may not be part of Thompson's psyche, it fails miserably communicating that because we're never given that sense in this movie.
Well, yeah, because like as a counterpoint, if you look at Terry Gilliam's adaptation of Fear and Loathing, I don't think it's a masterpiece like many people I know seem to, but at least it's visually distinct. And there are moments, like the hallucinatory sequences, where it's filmed in such a way that you can tell it is now subjective perspective. And that never happens in this film. Instead, we just get out images and outcomes. So, for instance, during the Super Bowl weekend episode, how it almost calls back to the book Fear and Loathing, where he's in a hotel just wreaking havoc, and there's these two dwarven bellhops that are just there. And, you know, they might be a hallucination of Thompson's. As the film presents it, they're just there. And so the film comes off as like this itemized list of quirky details.
Well, exactly, and there's even moments such as, you know, probably one of the most famous things about Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, both the book and the film adaptation, is the picking up of a hippie,
yes.
Hitchhiker sequence, which is done also in this film. And I would love for, you know, to put these things side by side and study the construction that Gilliam takes to how he approaches that scene in his film versus how Art Linson films it here, because it achieves two completely different aims there. And the end result in the case of Gilliam's is there's a very clear affect that Gilliam is searching for when he does that. I don't think Linson understands for one second, you know, how, you know, this is just something that happened that Thompson and Laszlo do. It doesn't actually have any sort of insight into their character. It's just like, hey, aren't these guys kind of wild as they sort of torture this young hitchhiker for no discernible reason?
Well, yeah. And that, I think, is the biggest failure of the film. By cutting out the political dimension, not saying every film needs to be political or have an overt message, but this film doesn't give you any insight into anybody's motivations. And Thompson and Acosta, they met and bonded over a very specific political moment. It was, what was his name? Ruben Velasquez, I think it was. He was a Mexican-American columnist for the LA Times, I think it was, who was killed by the LAPD, whether accidentally or deliberately, depends who you ask, but the whole reason they went to Las Vegas was so they could find a neutral ground where these two different men could talk about the politics and the implications of this case. And this is a film that is completely disinterested and purposely detached from any kind of political context. That's one thing. But when you don't give an insight into anybody's motivations, like, all we see here is that Thompson does what he feels like, but we never are given an indication of why he does this, or why this is important, or why he chooses to see this as important. Similarly, when Laszlo falls in with a bunch of, you know, Latin American revolutionaries and says he's adopting this cause, we're never given an indication of why or what this means to him. These are just, they become no more than Thompson stealing another reporter's press credentials and dosing him with acid on a plane. You know, it's just, it's everything in this film can be summarized as this is a thing that happens.
Well, it's also to the effect that, I mean, part of the way in which the film is ostensibly structured is we're kind of seeing objectively, and again, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas does do this as well in a much more effective manner, is the idea that there are limits to Thompson's extremes, as it were. There are places he simply either can't go or won't go. And the fact that, you know, again, whether you call him Dr. Gonzo or Laszlo, you know, that is a somewhat more, in some ways, dangerous individual than Thompson is. But the thing about it is we never get a sense as to why Thompson does or does not follow, you know, Laszlo at any given moment in this particular film.
Yeah, because like, at the end, their final meeting, it's sort of set up in the second episode, but by the third one, Laszlo appears literally in the last 10 minutes of the film to get on the plane, and he tells Thompson, I have the opportunity to develop this land and create my own socialist commune paradise, and I need you to come with me. I need your help. And Thompson's response is basically, nah.
Well, yeah.
And that's the end of the film. There's no discussion, there's no catharsis, there's no reason for why it's totally fine for him to go on freewheeling benders through Las Vegas or anything like that, or to do all these crazy things, but the moment that Laszlo, his friend, is, and in a film about that friendship, the moment that they finally walk away from each other, the fact that the film doesn't even go into any detail about why there's this divergence, it's like, what were they thinking? What's this movie supposed to be then?
Well, and that's the point. I don't think Linson, for certain we can point and say Linson had no, there was no take, there was no understanding, there was no purpose in what he's doing. I honestly think he saw, this is my chance to do a wacky drug comedy, and he kind of approached it like that and totally botched the job, because no, there's more to be done here with this material, and you're not doing it. I think it's kind of goes to the point then, and it sort of demonstrates just how wrongheaded this film is. You're right, you have this breaking point that we arrive at for no discernible reason. We then cut back at the end to Thompson in his, you know, house, you know, sitting with his dog, where he continues to talk about how things haven't gotten weird enough for him yet, To which begs the question, well, then why didn't you go with Laszlo if that's the case?
Exactly. It's like a film that heroizes Thompson because he refuses to actually take a position on anything. And his refusal is never made clear. It's like, this is also a film that it doesn't really explain why Nixon as a figure is so problematic and so, like, infuriating to Thompson. It's a film that just tells us, oh, well, he doesn't like the candidate. And,
well, yeah.
But there's never that indication of why. And if you read Fear and Loathing, if you read especially Thompson's eulogy for Richard Nixon, I think that is one of the most interesting pieces of journalism that I have ever read, because that very succinctly cuts to the quick of why Nixon is such, like, this boogeyman for an entire generation. And none of that happens here. So if you're not going to talk about why people do what they do, or why these actions are taken, or, like, this film doesn't have any sense of stakes, you know? Especially because the frame narration, we know that whatever happens, well, Thompson made it out okay.
Well, and that's the thing. The film doesn't even really climax. It just sort of stops.
Yeah, it ends, but it doesn't conclude.
Like, seriously, the last time we see Laszlo and Thompson together, they're both running across the airport trying to gather up these photographs. And it's just like, okay, so was Thompson going to go with them or not? I guess not, but what is happening here and why? I mean, it doesn't really make a lick of sense. And I mean, the best scene in the film, we should note, is, according to John Kate, was actually written by Thompson himself, which is the infamous confrontation between Thompson, you know, passing himself off as Harris from the Post, encountering Richard Nixon in the men's bathroom, which leads to a quote, which I do believe was featured in Thompson's Fear and Loathing in the Campaign Trail of 72, if I remember correctly, which is what Nixon quote supposedly thought of the doomed. There, and I will say, it is the best scene in the film. It's also the most overtly political scene. It also has absolutely nothing to do with the rest of the movie surrounding
it. Yeah, it's such a disconnect, because he's interrogating Nixon about, like, well, what about the downtrodden of society? What about the people who live on the fringes? What about people like... It makes so much sense that this scene was written by a different person, because here we're actually talking about society and culture and what is at stake in the election, and in Thompson's own worldview, what is at stake. But for the rest of the film, though, it's like Thompson himself, as presented and played by Murray and through this script, he doesn't care about any of this. So why is this cathartic moment where him finding out, oh, Nixon doesn't really care about anyone that doesn't conform to, like, square America. Why is that such a damning indictment, then? And again, this film fails to illustrate any kind of stakes or consequences, so it ultimately becomes meaningless.
Well, on top of which, I mean, and to compound the problems we were already talking about the way which the film whitewashes Acosta in the form of Laszlo, you know, when we do see, you know, the racial minorities of America in this film, or anybody who would be considered a minority figure in America, they are presented in such broad stereotypes.
Yeah, in this film, it's a very white and a very male film. Yeah, I can think of the two instances you're probably referring to.
Both in the Super Bowl segment.
There's two black men drinking wine at the fountain in front of the hotel, and there's the hilarious gag where they trade wine and a fedora for their Super Bowl tickets, which leads to these guys going on TV and, like, waving behind the broadcasters. And it becomes something to just point to and laugh at and say, ha, that's funny. And then the socialist revolutionaries that Laszlo introduces Thompson to, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, infuriates me, because here's where the whitewashing of the character, okay, here's where it completely, like, implodes the film. Because this is something that in real life Acosta was very committed to, very concerned with. by making Laszlo a non-othered figure, when he wants to get involved with these Latin revolutionaries, it comes off as just, it comes off as performative. Like, here's a slightly out of touch white dude who wants to play at revolutionary politics. So it comes off like he's just co-opting revolutionary rhetoric, and Laszlo looks foolish. And then the film presents the revolutionaries themselves as a bunch of, like, clowns. As a bunch of just clumsy idiots who get drunk and fire off guns. And it's like, oh, well, they're fighting for a cause, but they're doing it the wrong way. And Thompson's response to all this is to sneer at it with disdain. Even though earlier in the episode in question, him and Laszlo are driving through the countryside doing Herculean amounts of blow and firing guns randomly out the window. And this is one of those moments where it's like, okay, well, Thompson won't get on board with this. Why not? How is this any different?
Well, and again, to come back to, not to keep coming back to Terry Gilliam's Fear and Loathing, but I mean, when you take a look at how that film, you know, presents Thompson and Acosta there, I mean, those are, that's a movie which, again, is very clearly understands that these are, you know, politically minded individuals, but they are, you know, dangerous in certain ways. They are not straight up heroes of any sort. I mean, you get that wonderful scene in the diner.
Yeah. With,
I think it's Ellen Barkin, if I'm not mistaken, playing the waitress.
I think you may be right. It's been a while since I've seen it, but yeah.
Yeah, I was hoping to rewatch it beforehand, but time was not on my side here. But I mean, yeah, I mean, where, you know, you get a very clear sense as to how, you know, for all of Acosta's, you know, or Dr. Gonzo, we should say, because it's not literally Acosta, but for all of that figure's, you know, political ideals and good intentions, you know, there is something really, really dark about what he's doing. And Thompson recognizes that fact. And I think one of the things about that film is Thompson recognizes, or at least as Gilliam presents them, is that these are people who are, or at least Thompson is aware, he's not a hero. They're not good people, but they are, you know, sort of stumbling their way through this madness around them, as it were.
Well, and I think the way to make sense of that is Thompson's like, morality aside, I have the freedom to do this. Everyone else has the freedom to do as they please. And that's how he sort of reconciles it with himself.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, that scene in the diner, in the book, it's creepy. In the film, it's presented as creepy. And that's setting aside, like, the entire sequence where Dr. Gonzo and, depending on who you ask, Thompson himself in real life, effectively kidnap a young girl and commit statutory rape. But these are not heroes, but the difference between the two films is how they are presented. And in Where the Buffalo Roam, Thompson doesn't do anything of consequence. He doesn't care. He's not motivated. He just sneers at everything and does as he pleases. But the film situates him as this heroic, rebellious counterculture figure.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really does. I'd be curious to see in the confines of how people perceived Bill Murray at the time, how much of that factored into the choices that Lindzen made and others made in as it relates to this movie, because Murray at this point was still on Saturday Night Live at the time. And there are tales of, apparently, because Murray hung out with Thompson living at his place, which I guess is sort of a rite of passage.
Yeah.
If you're making these movies,
everybody seems to tell about working with Hunter Thompson.
Yeah. And that was the thing. And apparently Murray took a very serious method actor approach to this, where he refused to break character and apparently brought a lot of Thompson's traits to the behind the scenes of SNL, which didn't go over well with other cast members.
Well, he also took that method, or he carried the same character over into Caddyshack as well.
Very true. To much more effect there. But, I mean, it is certainly, it seems odd, and particularly when you look at even, like, the trailer, they do position this as a laugh-a-minute comedy, which, again, it's just so baffling of a choice. And yet, why we're trashing this movie, deservedly so, all through, without question, I do find this fairly watchable. Like, it's not, like, again, if you are deeply, deeply, deeply invested in both Thompson as a literary figure and Acosta as a real life figure, this film will for good reason, piss you off. There's no simple way to put it. Like, it will bother the hell out of you. And while like I said, it really is aggravating knowing that this could be so much better, there is a degree where it's like, there are elements about it I like Bill Murray in this film, I like Peter Boyle in this film, and there are individual sequences and moments that kind of work. Like, even things such as, you know, Bill Murray wandering into a courtroom as Thompson with a, you know, Bloody Mary.
Yep.
Yeah, in hand, in his tape recorder, and how he sort of gets the young person sitting beside him to gradually become sort of his, you know, accomplice in both drinking and recording events on his tape recorder.
And, like, I really like the courtroom sequence, too, that first episode, because we see Laszlo impassioned. This is the only point in the film where he makes an argument for what is at stake here. And he's saying, okay, and, like, he gets to the point where he punches out the district attorney because they decide that a kid being caught with a couple of joints when they kick his door down gets him 5 years in prison. And, like, that is much more reflective of, I think, what Thompson tries to do in his work and indicate that things matter. We're at a generational divide here, and, you know, it's just... And again, that belief in liberty. But after that sequence, when like, the narration basically brushes it all aside as, oh yeah, he went to prison, stopped being a lawyer, and then he just went to the fringes. Every time we see Laszlo after, he's buffoonish. He walks into the film again wearing a Nixon mask and just talking about revolutionary politics. And, like, there's nothing, it's so disconnected from how we're introduced to the character.
And then, and again, I mean, it wastes potentially interesting scenarios. Because, I mean, the idea of, you know, the Super Bowl might seem really disconnected from the politics, but when you consider the sort of weird cultural significance that America places on this one event every year, and how it has, particularly, I mean, for our generation, you know, in the past couple of years, how it has been politicized in terms of what players will do or won't do. There is raw material, you know, to really do something smart and savvy about the notion of, you know, football is sort of a political force in America and a sort of groundswell there. And it does nothing with it.
Yeah, instead we get Thompson getting drunk in a hotel room and convincing room service to put on football equipment and tackle each other into a wine rack. You know, it's just everything is there, and you're right, David. Like, it deals with heavy symbols. A presidential campaign, a courtroom, San Francisco in the 60s, the Super Bowl. It gives us all these symbols, and because it chooses to be so detached from its politics... that it doesn't investigate them. It doesn't mine it for anything. It just gives us images that can become gags.
Exactly. And I mean, it really is one of these things where it's just, this could be so much more. And I think everybody who was involved with it recognizes that this could and should have been so much more than it was.
Well, maybe except for Craig T. Nelson. He's probably happy that the hippie vibes were kept in check, if you follow him on Twitter these days. It's just, okay, like, do you want to know what my explanation for this film is?
Go nuts.
It's hearkening back to a very narrow golden age of looking back on counterculture. And maybe it's because Linson himself or Kay himself, they're kind of, because this is 1980, right?
Yeah, yes.
So we're firmly past the flower power years. It's post-Vietnam, post-Watergate, and they're looking back, and it's the same way that whenever a documentary about Woodstock comes up on PBS or something, everyone talks about how, like, oh, it was such a glorious time. Everything was new and everything was under question. Oh, we were taking the fight to the street. We were kicking open the doors of perception. It's like, well, no, that's just one very, very small and very Caucasian part of what was happening in the world. Like, this film is nostalgic for just the crazy heyday. Like, there's a reason it begins with San Francisco in 68. You know, it's just, it says nothing about civil rights, about changes in sexual and identity politics, about global movements towards cultural solidarity and towards independence. It detaches itself deliberately from all of that, and it still feels like just like, oh, look at, let's look back at how crazy and free we all were. But that's not what Thompson's work is about. That's not what Acosta's life was about. It's like Baudrillard. It's hearkening back to this idea of America that never actually was.
Well, absolutely. And I think it doesn't help as well that at this point in time, because there had been so little distance from the 1960s, well, we hadn't really, you know, you look at films of this period, they hadn't really codified how to present the 60s quite yet. I mean, there are certain things, particularly because, again, for that Shout Factory Blu-ray that's been released, they have finally restored the original score to this film, because for the longest time, all that was available was the Neil Young music that was written.
Yeah.
And every other soundtrack that was released was replaced with this weird electronic, you know, music that is completely, you know, was out of place.
See, that I think speaks to the film as well, though, because yes, Neil Young did do original music. He's credited as having the score on the film. And yeah, my understanding is that due to licensing issues, like, this film originally featured a ton of music of its era, like Hendrix's All Along the Watchtower.
It's Heard It Through the Grapevine by CCR. It, yeah, is part of it. And again, you can finally hear it as it was supposed to be.
Because otherwise, the version that I watch, it's just generic, like, dubbed in radio funk music. It's like, and as a result, I mean, it makes Neil Young's different renditions of Home on the Range, like, so much more impactful. But I think that really, that speaks to so many things greater than this film itself, where, yeah, because of money issues, all of a sudden everything that was distinctive about the music of this film got replaced with something generic that tried to emulate something that really was.
Yeah, and I mean, like I said, this is the thing, because the first time I watched it, it was back in university, and I picked up the newly released Universal DVD of it, not realizing that the score hit was not on it. And it was just sort of like, this just, something's off about this. And it wasn't until I started looking into it and I realized, oh my God, that is what you've done to this. Because it felt like, to me, watching it in that version, it felt like I hadn't actually watched the movie. Like it really, like having the score replaced in situations like that really irks me in a way that, like, I almost feel like it's not worth.
Well, you know, yeah, music is a deliberate compositional element, and even though it's not visual, it nonetheless forms our understanding of a film. Like, can you imagine a Hitchcock film if Bernard Herrmann's score got swapped out?
Absolutely not.
Can you imagine a Christopher Nolan film if Junkie XL got swapped out? But, like, look at Scorsese, for instance. He uses licensed music. He didn't write it, but, like, the use of Layla in Goodfellas, for instance. Yeah. Like, it informs so much more. It's as bad as when Ted Turner bought out all those classic Hollywood films and then decided he would colorize them, you know? Oh,
absolutely, yeah. That was...
Like, you can do it, I guess. It's yours to do it with, but it's not the same. Films are constructed deliberately, so when they're just like, we'll replace it with generic Biddle, it'll be the same. I think maybe that's also why this film doesn't at all come off as a period piece to me, based on the version I watched. But, like, there's no teeth to it.
Well, that's the thing. There's no teeth to it. It never, and again, I think you're quite right in the sense that, you know, this is a film that is not far enough removed to be able to make that distinction, because this still feels like it's happening in the moment in a way that it really shouldn't. At least, again, not as Art Linson's presenting it. And I think it's very telling, you know, you look a couple years earlier, you have something like The Deer Hunter, which is set around the same time as this film, but it's so much more effective at, you know, distinguishing the time difference of American Vietnam and America and where it had ended up. Apocalypse Now, even though it's a completely different type of film. I mean, again, you get a greater sense of America in Vietnam and the time distinction that it there with that movie.
This is a film that runs through well-worn territory. It just stumbles at every step. But let me ask you, because I've given sort of my thoughts on why this film emerges the way it does. But let me ask you, Dave, if you're flattening out difference, if you're reconfiguring the characters to remove them from their political context, and this film ultimately like doesn't deliver any kind of message or investigation into the friendship that it's presumably looking for, like, what's the point of this film?
And that's ultimately the problem, is I don't think it has a point. Like, I mean, like, and this is the thing, you can't do something about, even if it's a film, if Art Linson at least approached this movie as somebody who says, I hate Thompson completely, if he had even a perspective like that on the film, you know what? You know, I'm sure Thompson would hate it himself, but it doesn't matter. I mean, at least it would be a beat on it. There would be a sense that he has a perspective on these figures, but there's nothing. I mean, it's so nebulous in terms of what it wants to be that it ultimately is about nothing. Not to quote Seinfeld here, but I mean, that really is all this film is it really is about nothing other than getting to see shtick with Bill Murray, you know, drawing blood from a nurse.
It's images. Reasons. Yeah. There's never any motivation, right? And like the same way that even characters just come and go. Like everything is a MacGuffin in this film. Like Bruno Kirby, for instance, who he is like one of three actors that you actually know in this movie. His character Marty Lewis, I'm guessing that's a joke on Martin and Lewis. He's ostensibly Jan Wenner, right?
Yeah.
He is Thompson's publisher. He's there for two scenes of the film, and then he's just gone. In the hotel sequence, Blackie, you know the guy on the phone? Hey, Brownie, it's me, Blackie. What's the line? This scummy-looking bookie, you know, the film highlights this guy, and then he pops up in, like, two more subsequent shots, and then he is gone as well. It's just, this film introduces things and does nothing with it, and characters just drop out of the narrative because they're not needed. So why introduce them at all?
Well, and that's it. I mean, it's a film that it never commits enough to being a biopic to work as a biopic. It never commits enough to being a comedy to be funny throughout. It just, it's there. It really is there. And again, like, at best I can say is your reaction. I mean, it is a fascinating film as a historical artifact for, you know, as it relates to its subject matter. And if you are somebody who is interested in Thompson or Acosta, I would honestly say, even if the film makes you as angry as it clearly has made Andrew, it's still worth seeing just to try and see the first crack at trying to get this done.
I disagree with you there, David, because, yeah. Like, okay, when we talked about Heat, we disagreed on how we're supposed to read the film or what the film's ultimate message or position is.
Yes.
But I think we could at least agree that, well, it's a film that has a point, even if we disagree on the merits of that point or what the point even is. There's no point to this film. And so it doesn't even hit the level of fascinating failure. Like, I'm not fascinated by the fact that I think its treatment of real-life figures minimizing their politics, I think it's insulting. I do not identify as part of the Chicano movement. I am a Caucasian person, but just the way it treats real people in history and flattens them into nothing more than something to point and look at and go, ha-ha, like, that's not fascinating to me.
No, I said, sorry.
It's just like, That's all right. It's just like, I mean, I know other filmmakers like Mel Brooks, for instance, who, like, History of the World, for instance, I remember that, yeah, a lot of people criticize because that's the point where he stopped writing jokes, and then it's like, oh, three rabbis trying to walk through a doorway, and they get stuck. Well, that's funny because it looks funny. I feel like that's the vein of humor this film is going for. But in order to do that, they have to... they basically have to erase everything that these people really are and disconnect it from their on-screen representation. But in doing so, they also make the idea of struggling for cultural solidarity look as something to laugh at.
No, and I don't disagree with that. In fact, I completely agree with that. I just merely mean that, again, if you are somebody who is, you know, interested in Thompson, in that, I think, I mean, like it, or, you know, regardless as to whether the film works on, because it doesn't work one bit whatsoever, and it is absolutely as offensive as you're talking about. The film has a place as far in Thompson's personal history and in Acosta's history, like it or not, as, you know, something that did bring a significant degree of attention to them, even if it wasn't positive attention. And certainly in the case of Thompson, again, even though the film was a bomb, it still kind of helped cement that the caricature of Thompson that sort of became definitive throughout the 80s and into the 90s and was, you know, really cemented when we got to Fear and Loathing, even though that's a much smarter and savvier film than this one will ever be.
Well, certainly, I mean, so, I'm trying to think, like, even Doonesbury, the comic strip, the character of Duke, I mean, that started running in the mid-70s. And I mean, we already see a figuration of Thompson. It basically sounds like your ultimate argument is the value of this film is that it's the equivalent of the guy who goes on Reddit and opens a new thread and writes first.
Well, honestly, you're not wrong. I mean, this is the thing. Like, I'm not arguing for this film in the sake of this is a worthwhile movie. That's not what I'm trying to say. I'm not even, you know, it certainly isn't worthwhile in the sense that, you know, this is something that is a significant part of, you know, the Thompson canon, as it were, if we're going to put it in those terms. I simply mean that if you're predisposed to be interested in Thompson, as it were...
Well, yeah.
It's part and parcel of it, and yeah, I mean, the film at this point, its reputation isn't going to improve. I mean, this is the thing. This is not a cult classic that people are going to rediscover, as it were, and suddenly just declare 10 years from now, oh, it was a masterpiece all along.
Exactly. Or, like, it's not a hidden gem, but yeah. I'm trying to think of this in the context of the films we've looked at so far, because One from the Heart, historically important, it's a fascinating failure. Kiss of the Spider-Woman, it's a small film, it's, you know, sort of limited in scope, but it's also explicitly political. Street Fighter, for all its faults, it's fun and it's bonkers, and... Yes. Heat. I mean, it's a very polished production. And this film does none of those things.
Right. No, it doesn't.
It's not bad enough to make its production history interesting or memorable. It's not good enough to really have any positive reasons to watch it. Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. Like, it's a film where Thompson enthusiasts or completionists will look at. I think maybe you can make the argument that it's Bill Murray, an early instance of him trying to take a serious approach to acting on screen. I mean, like, the film gives him a character that's largely comedic, but I mean, this is a moment where he took the time to at least try and emulate Thompson.
And there are moments, we should say, where Murray is certainly better than the material he's given. Without doubt. I mean, there are
name one.
Like, I would say, again, you know, the whole, you know, even as ridiculous as that final scene between Laszlo and Thompson is after they get off the plane, Murray's trying his best to make it work. Like I said, again, the material isn't there, but you can see the effort in his eye as he tries to sort of, you know, bring some level of meaning to this. It fails, but I, again, effort appreciated. So,
Well, yeah, I guess then, Dave, should we go to our patent-pending bumper segment of hits and pits?
Absolutely.
All right, seeing as you picked this film, well, I think you just telegraphed, maybe we can agree on this one. One of the hits is that even though it's a terrible garbage film and a colossal waste of time, Peter Boyle and Bill Murray do give good performances for what they're given.
Absolutely, yeah. Now I think that one's safe to say because, again, I mean, they, God bless them, they're trying their best to make this thing work, even in moments that really, really don't.
They play off of each other pretty well. Like, they have a good sense of on-screen chemistry as actors. And
Yeah.
that you're right. I mean, that does come through even when the dialogue and the script does not.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, if anything, I kind of wish that they had had another film where they got to play either complete straight comedy without the strings attached of, all the various issues that come with doing Hunter S. Thompson. But I mean, as I get, I think maybe their one and only time together on screen, they do good. They do their best. So, absolutely kudos to them.
Just the way the film's structured, it prevents them from being on screen together. Like, this film would be so much more enjoyable if it was just the second episode and the bulk of the film was them driving together, bantering together, and just talking even. I mean, it's my dinner with Andre with a whole lot of cocaine, but yeah. I think if there is a bright spot of the film, it's how these two guys work with each other.
Yeah. But what about you, Andrew? What's your first pick here?
I would say it's probably more impactful than anything in the script, but Neil Young's score, specifically the leitmotif of Home on the Range. And it opens the film, it plays at different junctures, and every time we come back, it's stylized differently. And so the film opens with just an a cappella version of it, done in the traditional style. And as it moves, like it changes. We get a big band version, we get a string version, and we get a really haunting, like electric, echo-heavy guitar rendition of it. And I think that goes to what you were saying about like the Super Bowl and sort of these symbols, where this is a staple American song. This is very familiar. But every time we come back to it, it's that little bit sort of weirder than normal. And I think in that way, like it communicates a point of what was happening to America through the 1970s far better than anything else in the film. That is just it's familiar yet unfamiliar at the same time. And yeah, like Neil Young, I mean, Canada's own. I enjoy his music. It's very subtle. I think also the version I had, there's probably longer compositions that may not have made it. But yeah, especially against the generic public domain soundtrack that fills up the rest of the film, Neil Young's score does stand out, even in that minimal sense.
No, it is good work, and I mean, getting to hear it alongside the rest of the real soundtrack, it still comes off really well and is still very memorable in that sense.
Any more hits for you?
I'm gonna give two shout outs to two actors. One is Mark Metcalf as Dooley, because if you're gonna have a Nixon stooge, it might as well be the guy from Animal House.
Now, is he also the guy who is in the Twisted Sister video?
Yes,
I
it is.
thought so.
It is a damn man. He is, again, he's basically just asked to be a complete jackass on screen.
Yeah,
And
like I like to imagine that from Animal House through all of his appearances in any other media,
yeah.
it's all the same person just getting older.
Yeah. That would be stupendous.
Like, well, after college, I worked on the Nixon campaign, and then I had a son, and I yelled at him about music.
Oh, that would be fantastic.
And
But
who's the other?
the other, and I'm probably gonna botch the pronunciation of his name, so I do apologize in advance. But Rene Auberjonois,
Odo
I
himself.
yes, Odo himself, who again, he's given a really broad, weird performance as Harris from the Post.
Harris from the Post.
But he is, again, God bless him, he commits. And he's clearly, once he gets to start doing his tripped out performance there, which leads to the, again, really shouldn't work, but is kind of memorable, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds cockpit scene. He is, like I said, he's having fun and he's making it work, and he plays off of Bill Murray pretty darn well in the scene. I mean, he's one of those actors who he never fails to bring his A game there, and he brings it here and he does a solid job with it. So, I mean, salute to him on that one. You know, it's teeny bit, but I digress. So what about you, Andrew? Do you even have one more pick that you can give us on this one?
I'm stretching here, but yes, I have one. It's not the opening credit sequence, but the credits themselves. They're stylized very closely, and I think they actually were designed by Ralph Steadman,
yes,
who provided all the illustrations for Fear and Loathing and most of Thompson's other works.
Yeah.
They have been friends and collaborators for a good long time. Like, the images that we associate with Thompson come from Ralph Steadman. He's done poster design as well for other things. I know he did Winfield and I. He has a very distinct visual style. And, like, yeah, seeing it, even just the font and the weird splattering there, you know, it seems haphazard and weird. It's immediately distinctive. And it also is the first disappointment of the film when you realize that, nope, everything underneath it is just conventional and safe.
Yeah, no, you're quite right. And yeah, but yeah, on a related note, though, folks, see With Nail and I. It is amazing. But
yeah, did I say Winfield? Yikes. That's the kind of day it's been. With Nail and I. It's just, okay, now for Pitts. Should we just say everything except what we listed above?
I think there's a couple things that we probably haven't picked on that might be worth noting here.
All right, what haven't we harped on?
The ADR on Nixon, because, sweet Jesus, you really couldn't even try to make it seem as if the actor who's was performing in the same room with Murray on that one.
Yeah, I know there's a split credit. There's the physical actor who changed his name to Richard M. Dixon. I looked him up on IMDb. He has about, like, 15 acting credits, and all of them he's playing Richard Nixon. And he doesn't even look like him!
No, he doesn't look like him, but I'll give him at least credit. There's enough of a hairstyle resemblance where it's like, okay, you can kind of clearly pick up who it's supposed to be, but my God, the ADR work. Look, I understand you to make it even clearer, you wanted somebody who sounded much closer to Nixon, but it's very clearly, you know, ADR work to the point where it's distracting. Like, seriously, at that point, just keep the original vocal performance in it. Or at the very least, cut around more around him so that when he does things like his peculiar, you know, urinating in pain noises, that it doesn't look like it's obviously out of sync with what the actor's doing. I mean,
yeah,
come on, folks.
It's just, on the plus side, though, for anyone who thinks that Watchmen is the worst presentation of Nixon in film, look no further.
Yeah, I guess that's... what about you, Andrew? Anything that you haven't, you know, bludgeoned over the head?
Again, it's just, what do you say about a film that forgets what it's actually about halfway through its duration? I think that really says it all.
Yeah, you're not wrong, really. I mean, it is sad. I mean, and frustrating there. And I think that's just it. I mean, it is, again, it's just the wasted potential combined with the offensiveness of what was done is just very... It's depressing, I guess, is really the way to look at it. It's just really all you can really say. And to be honest, yeah, I don't know whether there is any more that can be said about Where the Buffalo Roams that we haven't sort of harped on at this point. So.
Well, I guess if that brings us to the end of our stay in Bat Country, then
yes.
I guess it's my turn to take the wheel, is it not?
Yes, it is. So where are you taking us next year, Andrew?
Well, I think according to this map, I am going to head west actually this time. And I think
Okay.
we're going to follow the Neil Young Memorial Parkway
Yep.
and tour into a little film directed by Jim Jarmusch called Dead Man, which also features a score by Neil Young, and I think is going to be interesting to read it in tandem with some of the politics of this film. But yes, Dead Man, Jim Jarmusch's early 90s neo-Western, a sort of Western noir. And yeah, I'm very curious to talk about this film with you, Dave.
Yeah, no, I'm excited to revisit it again because it is one hell of a movie.
Yeah, there's not much like it, and I mean, there's not much like Hunter S. Thompson, and we didn't see it here, so at least let's get something memorable for our next journey.
Yep, absolutely. So, until then, you can find me on Twitter at 24 panels. Andrew, I'm assuming you still haven't gotten a new Twitter handle at this point. Am I correct in that?
I still have not gotten a new Twitter handle, but you can, in the meantime, quick plug, you can search me, Andrew Cantigizer, on SoundCloud, and you can listen to some of the music that I've been working on. And hopefully, when I actually do set up a Twitter account, you'll send me something beyond just hate mail.
Yeah, no, that is absolutely the case. Keep the hate mail coming to me. I can take it. Yeah, so until next time, I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Cantigizer, and remember, what was our bumper line? Adventure
Bye,
may
folks.
scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Goodbye, folks.
Goodbye.